Hello and welcome to the podcast, What We Teach Our Children. I'm Kim Clyden. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent and empowered children? And they say it takes a village, or what we might call today a community. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded though by people who can support us, your family, friends and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Children are our future, and the very existence of the human race depends on what we teach them. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. This podcast is about everyone who plays a role in that story at every level of society. I'm excited to introduce to you my latest guest, Andrea Canaris, a social scientist, social planner, who's worked in legislation, policy and policy development, projects, planning approvals and measuring social impacts, effectively understanding how to maximise benefits whilst minimising harm to individuals, groups and communities through their delivery. Social scientists study society, humans and human behaviour. So I'm keen to learn how Andrea's knowledge can help us understand the role we play in raising children in this society we've created. Andrea, as someone who studies human behaviour over the most progressive decades in human history, what would you say has been one of the greatest challenges we've faced due to not researching the social impacts of something we've introduced?
Social media and mobile phones, smartphones in particular. I don't think the old flip phones, I don't think they're necessarily damaging in any way. In fact, I think that they're fantastic things, right? They help us connect. They help us stay safe. I think for women in particular and young girls in particular, being able to, when you're out, have a phone if something happens is an example of a really great positive impact on society when we have some of these technologies. I think smartphones have got wonderful pluses. They also have a lot of negatives that you couldn't have had the consequences for, or they haven't been debated openly enough until the after fact. Like, we've already been exposed to it for so long, especially children on smartphones, right? It's like a gateway to all the things that if they were in the real world, they wouldn't have access to, and yet they can get on social media and onto a smartphone and they can access just about anything.
Anything in the world.
It's incredible.
It is incredible. Yeah. And I think that what we're seeing now is direct consequences of introducing that to a population that weren't ready. Now, the government has recently announced that they're looking at introducing laws around social media and having access to that. Is it a case of the horse has already bolted, though, for that generation?
I mean, for that generation, obviously, there is a, like, they already have access to it, so what do you do? Sure. But I don't think that's an argument for not exploring, is there an age limit that's appropriate for allowing access to this? We don't let young people drink. We don't let them gamble. We don't let them do a lot of things, and we put age restrictions on it, driving, lots of things that we just say, you know, yeah, you're going to have to use it. And we have varying ages, right? From, you know, young right through to 20, you know, 19, they can't vote at 12. And so there's lots of things that we put age restrictions around. So we're not banning it, saying you're never going to be able to use it. We're just saying it's probably not appropriate for you to have free access to this at such a young age. From a human development perspective, that makes sense, right? Our brains aren't fully developed. The way in which smartphones affect the dopamine system and the brain and all those sorts of things that we're learning now, it makes perfect sense that we should really limit access to this to young children. Not to mention the fact that, like you alluded to, they can literally access anything in the world on a smartphone.
But other people can access them as well, which is where the cyberbullying has become a real issue.
And even worse, like if you want to get worse, we're talking about, you know, exposing children to what would be sexual abuse, like flashing them on screens, on exposing them to sexual content that they really should not have access to. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day and she made a really good analogy, and it was a good one. It's like, would you take a child and drop them into the valley and leave them there for 2 hours on their own on a Friday and Saturday night? The answer would be a resounding hell no. And yet, in essence, for some reason, we tend to think of the internet like it's different, like it's there's like the real world and then there's the internet. And I would love to see people start thinking about the internet in the same way they think about anything else in this world that we think about. So when you're talking about kids and should we ban it, it's like, well, there's plenty of things we ban for kids, so why wouldn't we, right? And the fact that we maybe got it wrong previously in terms of, you know, kids having access, to answer your question, it's like it shouldn't stop us from going, we've learned something here now, we know more than we did before. It just means we're going to have to think about how do you transition to the new legislation, right?
Is it about banning it or is it about creating controls and some sort of rules around use for younger people?
I think there's lots of things to unpack there. And one is that what smartphones do is, and if you listen to any parents talking about smartphones, it's really interesting because they're kind of giving you the clue. It's really hard for them, right? If you don't ban a smartphone, and I don't think you have to ban social media, but if you ban the access to the smartphone, that puts power back into the parents' hands because the child can't just go get a smartphone. It's easier for them to have conversations around their kids around use of social media and when they use it and how they use it, because they're going to have to use their parents' device to do it, which means they're going to have to ask the parents. The parents will know that they're on there. They'll know how long they're on there. It'll be easier than for them to put up their own personal family rules around how long, when, what social media. And then parents can sort of go, okay, because they might be talking to a 16-year-old. Let's assume they say land on 16. Right? They might land on 14, whatever. But at least those parents have the ability to go, when they've got a 12-year-old guy, why can't I have it? Because it's illegal. That shuts down a discussion. It makes it easier for parents. And most parents will tell you the hardest thing they have is, how do I say no when every other kid at school has it? And even if I don't want it, they're just going to school and using somebody else's social media account, right? And they have accounts they don't know about. And I think what we need to do and what our government needs to do is, like you said, just make it easier for parents to make the decision they want to stay. You don't want the government in families' business too much, but you want to allow them to develop laws that support parents to make the right decision for their kids in their family and their home.
Definitely. I agree with you on all of that.
To manage it easier, because, you know, it must be so, I know it's so hard. I see my sisters and I've seen my brothers struggle with this with my nieces and nephews as they're growing up. But this has probably been one of the hardest things that they know how to manage. And, you know, some of those things around social media and parents, like, I know from my experience with my nieces and nephews that they know the internet better than we do. You no sooner shut one account up, they've opened another one. Like, they are more savvy at it than we are.
Where do they go for that type of information as well? I mean, there's so much out there. I was talking to Kari Sutton in a previous episode. She works with people in that situation, parents, teachers, early childhood educators, because she understands how important it is to get those early years right. And it's not just what we say or what we educate them with, it's really what we do. How important is it to feel connected to your family? What's the neuroscience around that connection and human touch say?
Oh my goodness, this is probably my passion area. This is where, you know, connectedness is the number one thing we need as human beings. We need to be connected first to our family, to our friends, and to broader society. And this is the tragedy side effect of the COVID lockdowns. It has separated people, sometimes even from family, but definitely from the broader incidental connectedness, and maybe even sometimes friends that's, you know, lost contact with. And it's really, really poor. All the social science is very strong on this and has for a long time, that in fact, you know, social connectedness is probably the most important thing for humans to thrive. You might be able to exist with limited to no contact. You will not thrive, though. Thriving without that is very difficult. And human touch is important. And face-to-face is king. All the data shows face-to-face communication is the number one. It's king. It's there's a drastic difference between even video, which thank God it's great because it helps people stay connected. So these, I'm not demonizing these things. I think we should have them. In fact, I think they're wonderful inventions to supplement human connectedness, right? The connection should be first and foremost as face-to-face as possible whenever you can. And then when you can't, supplement it with your video and your telephone calls and whatever else. And that makes it for a beautiful thing that we never used to be able to do, because we used to be able to, you know, have to wait until we saw people. Now, if you've got family who live overseas, you can stay connected through video. So I think it's a wonderful, beautiful thing that we have. But we should certainly strive also for as much face-to-face as we can.
What impacts do we continue to see today, 4 years on from COVID lockdowns?
Well, people still aren't in the office, are they? We've seen an increase in depression among youth. I mean, we've got the depression and the mental health impacts on people through to the disconnectedness. Connectedness and mental health has been linked in for a long time. So anyone who's been to a psychologist's office or a psychiatrist's office or a counselor's office will know that one of the things they'll always ask you is, how connected are you to family? How connected are you to friends? And how connected are you to the society? And the reason for that is because connectedness is core for our health and well-being. It's really important for our mental health and well-being. Critically important. And that goes for, and this is the thing that I think has been underrated, because I think there was a research, and it was a TED talk. I'd love to find it, and maybe if I can find it, send it to you. But they did the top 10 things around connectedness and health and well-being. And what shocked most of them that was in the top three was connected to just the broader society. So what we're talking about is incidental interactions. So I go and have a coffee and I have that chat to the person at the coffee shop on my way to work, or I'm doing my walk in the morning and the person walking past me with their dog goes, hi. Being seen, being acknowledged, those things are actually extremely good for our mental health. Just, you know, the checkout person at Woolworths or Coles instead of the self-checkouts, like that's really sad. Like, but having that person go, hi, how was your day? For some people, being asked, how was your day, that might have been the only person who's spoken to them that day.
I feel right? The same when I'm walking through a shopping centre and someone smiles, you know, and I smile back. It's that reciprocity of being seen. So it's just simple things, isn't it, that keep us connected to people we don't even know.
There's an interesting thing in health, because I've had a bit of time in health too. And one of the things that happens in health, like there are people who turn up to emergency rooms just to sit there because medical staff, Someone will ask them how they are. How are you? Are you okay? Are you looking for something? People are lonely. Loneliness is through the roof, and that's terrible. And if you're going to stay at home all the time, and I know that I myself am in the process of looking to find an office because I work from home, because I run my business from home. It's in startup phase. And I also live alone. So it's not a good recipe. You need that connectedness. So I'm in the process of getting out because I know that that's a long period. Short periods of time is fine. Long periods of time, that's not good. Agoraphobia is an issue for a reason, right?
And it's not just elderly people. I mean, we think of loneliness as something that's restricted to elderly people.
No, it's not. And in fact, increasingly, here's the thing, interesting thing. City people are more likely to be lonely than country people. Country people tend to be more connected. They have more connected, stronger bonds in their communities. They tend to be tight-knit communities. City people usually tend to be people who have moved away from their core family or where they live and they've moved into the city. They're not necessarily living next to their family in a connected society. Loneliness can be a big problem, and it's an increasing problem. People are increasingly lonely, and young people are lonely, and that's got to be one of the saddest things ever, is to see young people lonely. Because I don't know about you, Kim, but when I was young, we were always out with our friends. And this is the other problem with social media, and why I personally would love to see it actually illegal for kids under the age of, say, 16, because I think by then their social bonds should be so strong that social media wouldn't necessarily break it, right? Because if I think back to my young years, we were just always with our friends face to face. You were playing sport with them. You were hanging out with them before school, after school, during school. Now you see people, and I I had a friend mention this to me the other day. We were out and she was saying how many people you go to a restaurant now and you see them and they're on their phone instead of communicating and talking to each other. So, you know, it does. There's some really good research, and you mentioned the neuroscience, and I would encourage people to look at people like Huberman and Dr. Amen, that's A-M-E-N, who do a lot of work around neuroscience, around connectedness, around how to manage stress, and the effects of things like social media and the devices on our dopamine system, that it is actually addictive, and strategies for how you can minimize the damage to that and manage it a bit better. Because I think we talk about kids, but it's to help kids manage it, then us as adults have to be better at managing it, right? Because we're struggling with it. We didn't grow up with it. So we engage with it probably not in the best, most healthy way.
It is furthest from my mind each day because I'm like you, love to have a conversation, to connect with people, especially to be in their presence. And even through COVID, I never stopped hugging. What do we do to remain, you know, feeling loved and safe and secure?
Look, I think as hard as it might feel, to go into the workplace or to make a friend is like feel you can feel scared, but don't let it stop you. Because once you've done it once, and this is the wonderful thing about the neuroscience, we know that neuroplasticity now is that you can learn things, you can learn new pathways in your brain. So at first, things that make you feel scared, things that make you feel anxious or worried, do them anyway. Because what you're doing is your brain is, you'll do it and realize that there was nothing really to be scared about. It was nowhere near as bad as we thought it was going to be. And any of us who have done anything we were scared of before can tell you that. I had a big fear of heights that took me a long time to overcome, but it was going through it that helped do it. And then my brain knows it's fine. And my brain, that new pathway gets exercised. You start to know that you're safe and it's fine. And yes, touch, like give your friends hugs.
Give your children hugs. Children, give your parents hugs.
Yeah, exactly. Hug your friends. Like definitely connect with people in a really meaningful way. Be vulnerable a bit. Tell them you need help. If you're feeling lonely, if you're feeling sad, any of those things, tell someone.
And always ask if someone else is willing to hug you.
Yes. Do you mind if I give you a hug? It's not a bad way to start before you just jump in.
I sometimes joke I have to pay people to touch me, you know, massage, therapy,
well,
a chiropractor.
Really good way, because some people, you know, might not have an intimate partner or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Touch is really important.
It's true.
Giving yourself a hug on the shoulders and you stroke down.
Yeah.
It's self-soothing and it's giving yourself a hug and it can release the same oxytocin, having a massage. All those things are great. They're good. Having a pet.
Andrea, it's been a delight speaking with you, getting to know you, and I think you might be a serial offender on this podcast moving forward. You'll be my go-to social researcher. Cannot wait to speak with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Kim, for having me. It's been lovely talking to you.
Social Impact Advisor and Director of All Things Social Impact, Andrea Canaris, sharing her wealth of knowledge studying society, humans and human behaviour with me, Kim Clyden, and of course, you. Do you know someone who could benefit from a hug? Introducing the concept of hugging whilst respecting consent and body autonomy of another person can be challenging with young children. There is an early childhood approved book called Huggle, Snuggle, Cuddle that may help you create a conversation. You can check out Mimi's children's books on Facebook and my website, kimclyden.com. Next week, we'll meet Philippa Scott, a family architect supporting parents and those planning to raise children through a holistic approach that educates, regulates, and heals. Don't miss her tips to create a safe and nurturing home, taking you from overwhelm to empowered. Looking forward to it. Join us then. This podcast is recorded at Launchpad Studios thanks to Split Spaces, a nest for new ideas. Thank you.